Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, unable to be with us today, I'm reminded of the good work that he does with his clients at the Hazelton Betty Ford Center here in West Los Angeles. But not to worry, he will be back soon. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. I can't tell you how great it makes us feel when we get your comments that not only talk about how we're doing, but it talks about how much you're enjoying listening to our guests. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain while bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. We will introduce you to talented authors, caring people, and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for your family. Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, today, we're going to talk a little bit about being together, or sometimes being together and why it doesn't feel that way. You know, many of us were raised not to show our emotions, or found that when we did, we felt deep emotional pain. Now, take that and fast forward to becoming an adult. How do we deal with emotions? For some, we bury them. But how does that affect those around us? Well, living with an emotionally absent partner can be overwhelming. Constantly overcoming a silent distance can leave the sense that, you know, the give and take in our relationship has disappeared. But according to our guest today, even the most broken relationship can be reinvigorated. Now, to share more about this is Dr. Holly Parker, or Dr. Holly, as she's more playfully known. Dr. Holly is a psychologist with a passion for walking alongside people as they invest in their future selves by cultivating a more enriching, vibrant life in the here and now. Now, she obtained her PhD in experimental psychopathology from Harvard University, where she conducted research and was a Karen Stone Fellow and Sackler Scholar. Now, having a desire to uplift people through human connection also, Dr. Holly re-specialized in clinical psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Presently, she engages in clinical work, teaching, public education, and writing. She's a lecturer at Harvard University, where she teaches the psychology of close relationships. And she is the author of two books, When Reality Bites, How Denial Helps, and What to Do When It Hurts. And her latest book, If We're Together, Why Do I Feel So Alone? How to Build Intimacy with an Emotionally Unavailable Partner. Now, she also delves into an assortment of topics on her blog and in media interviews through outlets such as Self Magazine, Glamour, Cosmopolitan, Prevention, Chicago Tribune, the ABC News, and many more. So with no further ado, Dr. Holly, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Oh, thank you so much, Alan. I just really want to start off by saying that I hope you're having a beautiful day. I hope your listeners are as well. And it is such an honor to be on your show. I just really applaud the work that you do where families can improve their relationships. That casts a long, bright light over the course of people's relationships in the years to come. And by extension, it really uplifts their quality of life. So keep doing what you're doing. Really amazing work.
Thank you so much for that. And when Jan, our producer, told us about your book and about this subject, I was really looking forward to it because I think that many of us come from a generation where, and maybe more so with males, we were not really trained to show our emotions. What you've done as far as putting together a book and talking about it and getting all of us to talk about it a little bit, I think has huge benefits for anybody who has been in that situation, either as the person who has not figured out how to explain and how to project their emotions, but also that person who is in that relationship with them. So thank you for addressing this.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And, you know, it really is something when we think about relationships. I mean, you mentioned generational factors. You talked about family. I mean, we do not exist in a bubble. I mean, we are nested within our relationships. We are nested within our larger social circle. We're nested in a culture. And it's pretty amazing how, if we think about all of these different layers, they are all impacting each other. And that's also true when we think about family units, families, just like, you know, culture, just like couples are their own little culture. Couples all have their own norms, their own ways of doing things, ideas about what's acceptable, what's not. Certainly families have that too. And, families can transmit, and they do transmit, very different messages about what emotions, whether it's okay to air emotions at all, or in some cases, maybe some emotions are considered okay and others are considered not. There are cultural transmissions within families about what one can expect from the people in their lives. Can loved ones be relied on? Can Are they people who we can really depend on and reach out to? Or is it the case that sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not, and we don't know what's going to happen, or maybe they're never there? And all of those things, those messages we certainly take with us. And they're immensely influential. Thankfully, they don't have to be destiny, but they certainly are influential, and they can cast a long shadow in the relationships that we have in the present.
Well, and I love the fact of your point of it doesn't have to be destiny. Now, as I said in your introduction, you started in research. So when you decided to write this book, tell us a little bit about your research, because I know as someone who has traveled around the world, I find that when I'm in a different culture, they have completely different ways in which they either show emotion or choose not to.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, where I really, in the context of my research, I came into the field of relationships really from the perspective of loss. I did research on coping and resilience in people who'd lost loved ones to suicide. Such a difficult, painful loss, and really explored with people how they navigate that, how do they come to terms with it, how do they rebuild their lives, and from there I really continued trying to learn about relationships, teaching about relationships, extending that into my clinical work. Once I became a clinician, it's amazing to me, it never ceases to surprise me how influential relationships are. I mean, in everything, and in when we think about the quality of our lives, one of the things that I invite people to do, just to help them get a visceral sense of this, and I would invite your listeners to think about this too, just imagine all of the moments in your life when you were at your best, when you felt on top of the world, when you felt just delightedly happy, you felt safe, you felt secure, life feels meaningful, and oftentimes those moments aren't ones that are solitary. They happen in the context of the relationships we have with others. And on the flip side, when we think about those moments of despair, of feeling alone, of really wanting to reach out, but feeling just so sad or so angry or whatever it might be, oftentimes, the vast majority of the times, those moments involve relationships too. So, they color our lives in these powerful ways. And then when we think about the rules that we get from relationships, relationships form a lot of what we believe is acceptable, is unacceptable. Relationships can be shaming. Relationships can really be uplifting and give us permission to acknowledge things that, that maybe we haven't been willing to touch. I think in terms of the message that that relationships give us, even within a particular culture, for example, even in the United States, there's tremendous variability around what kinds of emotions people believe are acceptable to have, what aren't, and also what the consequences will be if they express them or how they express them. It's pretty incredible how that affects people's intimate relationships. So, for example, someone may feel, and this is something that I've seen a lot that's actually quite common, is people will think that they're expressing their feelings, and what comes out is anger. So a lot of different painful emotions wind up getting funneled into anger, and anger is something that is seen as, somehow acceptable. Also, at a deeper level, it's also less vulnerable. When we feel anger is actually what's called an approach emotion. So if you see two dogs who are about to fight, right, they actually approach each other. So it's actually an emotion where there's much less vulnerability. I've heard people make comments when a relationship ends or a relationship is about to end, or someone's thinking about ending a relationship, in which they'll say, God, I wish I could hate that person. Right? It often feels so much easier, whereas, what's really going on, and this happens for a lot of couples, is they'll be very attuned to the anger, but won't necessarily be attuned to the fear, to the sadness that's underneath, because that also involves much more of a risk. So that's something that's culturally very common.
Now, before we go too much more into that intimate relationship, let's talk a little bit about the relationships that are starting to form at a much younger age. And again, with the focus being around family, in this day and age, going into school with the cliques and the kids that come home and say, well, I can't hang out with these people, or these people are reacting in this fashion. What are some of the things that we can do for our children to get a couple of steps ahead as they go through those years?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think that one thing that's really important is that when we have children in the home, right, it's such a dilemma for parents, because we can manage the talking about culture, right, within families. We can manage the culture that children are in at home, but then when they go out to school, that's where it gets a lot harder, right, because they're exposed to all kinds of difficult elements, and it's really painful to see them go, and so many parents really want to be able to protect their kids and help their kids to feel loved and safe and secure, even when they're outside the home. And one of the challenges is that for kids, there is, let's be honest, there is enormous pressure that kids face to conform. Research actually suggests that conformity, especially especially as kids are heading into their teen years, preteen, going into their teen years in high school, reaches a peak. And then the desire to conform starts to level off, a bit more as people go into college. So there's this, you know, angst that a lot of people feel to try to fit in. They want to be accepted. They're in this weird nether space of trying to, you know, they're not children anymore exactly, but they're not adults either. They're not totally in the home, you know, nestled with their parents as much anymore, but they're not all the way out on their own. And so there are, you know, relational issues that are in play. There are developmental transitional issues that are in play. And I think a couple things are really important. When we think about the idea, and this goes back to, some of the research on early development and attachment. As humans, we have these two competing needs. We need connectedness, mm-hmm. and we also need a sense of autonomy. And for children, this desire to, you know, both, you know, kind of go out and explore, but also exploring is a lot easier if they know they have something steady to come back to. An example that I like to give people when I'm teaching this concept is I'll say, you know, when you left your apartment or your home today, did you worry at all about whether it was going to disappear? Or whether it was going to be there when you came back for the most part. And people look at me like I'm a little bit crazy. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Why would I worry about that? And I say, okay, so you don't think it's going to disappear on you? And no. And so you feel like you can pretty confidently go out, live your life, because you know your home's waiting for you steady. But what if sometimes when you came back it was gone? It just vanished. How would your behavior be different, right? And typically, you know, people agree that they would maybe hover more. They would be less secure. They'd be more afraid as they went out into the world. They wouldn't have the sense that they could take on the things they want to take on. And in fact, if their home was never there, then they would feel like, you know, they wouldn't even reach back to it to depend on it. They might even shut off and pretend that they don't care. So if we think about kids going out into their world, you know, into this world that as parents, we don't have any control over, and they're dealing with kids that, you know, there can be kids who are very nice, and then there can also be bullies, and there can be this, pressure to conform, and, a lot of different pressures that kids are dealing with, especially when we think about, the pressures to succeed in school, all the different extracurriculars, comparison with their peers who are, you know, really pushing themselves hard. That's a lot for kids to go out into the world with. And so one of the most important things that parents can do is to provide that secure foundation for their kids, because if kids know that they have a steady, supportive home where they can come back and they can talk about what their feelings are, that their emotions will be heard, that their needs are honored, that they get quality time with their parents, that is one of the biggest and simplest gifts that parents can give. And it can be hard because families are busy. Parenting is a full-time job. It can be difficult. And, and sometimes I think well-intentioned parents can try to smooth over a child's fears, right, by maybe reassuring them or trying to take away the problem. And not that reassurance is a bad thing. Reassurance is a beautiful thing, but also making space for a child's feelings, for those fears, for those anxieties, and recognizing that, even though it may seem silly, right, at some level, parents may go, oh, God, you know what, you're not going to care about what this other kid thinks in a few years. Don't even worry about it, right? But even though that is a very understandable place to come from, because the parent is on the other side of all of that drama.
Been there.
Yeah, been there, exactly, right? And it's not that, again, it's not that that kind of reassurance can't happen, and to say, you know what, trust me, in a few years, you're going to be, you know, you're not even going to care. But also to make space for the feelings that are there. So both to listen and to reassure. Because the more that kids feel like they've got a secure foundation to come back to, that they can depend on their parents, and they know that no matter what happens, that there is emotional safety, then that's the biggest gift. So, you know, for example, one thing that parents can do is, and this is something that often doesn't occur to parents, I think, because parenting is such a full-time job, is to take care of oneself. The literature on relationships shows that when we're good to ourselves, when we're self-compassionate, when we take good care of ourselves, we're actually better partners, we're better parents, we're better friends in general. So for parents to take care of themselves and also focus on nurturing the relationship with their child as much as they can. The second thing also is, I think that one thing that parents can do, and this gets at the second piece, is when kids go out and explore. I think well-intentioned parents, there's a lot of talk about parents who try to, and a number of articles that have been written on parents who, from a well-intentioned place, try to shield their kids from difficult interactions. You know, they try to intervene perhaps too much. And even though this comes with good intentions, ultimately, you know, growth, there's growth that comes from struggle. So for parents to kind of give kids space, you know, security and support, but also space for them to really find their footing, find their social footing, have conversations with them about the need they feel to conform. You know, have conversations with them about some of their judgments about other people. You know, kind of what do they make of that? You know, what kind of relationships do they want? What do they believe, you know, they deserve? How do they want to handle that? And helping kids to talk through some of their own solutions can really be a way of helping them to figure out how they want to handle different social issues and can give them better strength in the process.
Exactly. And if you fix everything for them, what are you preparing them for when they become adults?
Exactly.
You know, I know that I have a great example of that with my oldest son. And he got bullied at school, and he had a young man that kept coming up to him and saying, you know, give me money for lunch. And my son said, well, I don't have any today. Or I would help you. And so the next day, the boy came up and said, you know, give me $5 for lunch, you know, or I'll beat you up. And so my son gives him like $3 and says, that's all I've got. I brought my lunch today, so I don't need it. But so he took the money. The next day, the boy came back and said, you owe me $2. Give me the other $2 or I'm going to beat you up. And he says, well, I didn't owe you it in the first place. You said you were hungry, so I gave you money. So the boy said, well, tomorrow I'm going to beat you up, you know, if you don't bring me money. And was trying to set up this sort of regular situation with someone. And well, as my son told me that, as a parent, I started to immediately go into this mode of, okay, I'm going there tomorrow. I'm talking with the principal. We're going to fix this. This is not going to happen. You know, he's described this other child as being twice as big as him. And all of these emotions started going in me. And my son looked at me and he goes, Dad, can you not fix this? You know, I'm telling you about it, but at the same time, I'll take care of it. You know, and so and it was driving me crazy. So the part that I still felt that I had to do was I typed up everything that he had told me over the past 2 days and of everything that transpired. And I put a copy of it in an envelope in his backpack and I kept a copy myself. And I said, if anything happens, give this to whoever the authority is there, the teacher or the principal or whatever. And as it turned out, the boy did, after school, try and fight with him. And my son, because he had a martial arts background, when the boy swung at him, my son hit him and the boy went down. And he just stood over him and said, just stay there. Well, the teachers ran up, and the teachers only see the second, you know, they don't see the one that swings and misses.
Yeah, of course.
They only see the one that hits.
Right.
So they take both of them to the office, and then they call me, and I said, you know, did my son give you the paper? And so they get the paper out of the backpack. And sure enough, after reading that and talking to a few other kids, the other boy got suspended. My son didn't. And the principal actually said that they were very happy about the fact that once the boy was down, he didn't pursue it. He hit him once, he went down, and that was it. You know, he just stood there like, I'm not trying to be a bully. I'm not trying to make you look bad, but I'm also not going to let you harm me. But that was the most difficult thing for me. I couldn't think that whole day. I was at the office going, oh, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
So yes, that desire to fix and to help. And it's so strong. But I love the fact that in his case, you know, he understood it and actually, you know, took the initiative to say, just, you know, let me handle it.
Yeah, that, you know, that's such a perfect example, right? And I love that story, right? Because you really highlighted how hard it is to sit back and not intervene. That a natural instinct would be to jump in and, okay, you know, I'm your parent, I'm going to protect you just like I protect you at home. I'm going to protect you out in the world, and I'm going to come and make everything better. And so many parents, you know, wind up doing that. And even though it comes from just the most loving place, it really, you know, one thing that I think about, when I think about kind of protecting children in all kinds of different circumstances like that, right? Like kind of intervening and, you know, protecting them from the natural challenges that they'll have to face is, at what point does intervention end? You know, and so if kids grow up learning that when anything bad happens or anything stressful happens, that their parents going to come in and make it go away, or their parents going to come in and fix it for them, then as you rightly asked, what are they being prepared for? And what happens when they get older? Because the challenges tend to get greater, right? They don't get less when people are kids typically. And so, you know, for people to kind of, you know, be able to find themselves, you know, there's something very powerful, I think, in facing discomfort. You know, there's a wonderful quote that I love that's, you know, that probably many of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard. Life begins at the edge of your comfort zone. And when we face challenges, you know, when we are uncomfortable, and granted, you know, being bullied and facing difficulties, I mean, that's, you know, certainly, you know, we don't want that. But when we do face barriers and obstacles, to be able to take them on and not have them wiped away, but to really show ourselves that we can face them and overcome them, that's what really instills mastery and really helps strengthen people's coping repertoire. And they learn more about just what they're capable of. And I'm sure your son, thanks to your willingness to show restraint and to both give him security and give him space, he found a lot more mastery.
Yeah, and it set him up in such a way that, well, nobody ever, for the rest of his time at that school, ever even thought about bullying him, you know. So it was, you know, it became a true win-win situation in the sense that, you know, he didn't want to have to hit anybody, but once he did, it was a matter of, well, okay, you know, nobody's going to now do that again. And he learned that if he does stand up for himself, which obviously he carries into adulthood. So now we are talking about our emotions. We are talking about as far as, you know, if we're together, you know, why can I feel so alone? We've been talking about how it relates to children. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about how it relates in our own intimate relationships. So stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We're talking with Dr. Holly Parker, and we are discussing her new book, If We're Together, Why Do I Feel So Alone? How to Build Intimacy with an Emotionally Unavailable Partner. So, Dr. Holly, let's go right into that part of it. How can we create more of a healthy emotional connection?
I just love that question, because whenever I talk about how people can build relationships, I think it hits on something that is one of the most fascinating aspects of relationships. And by the way, this applies not only to intimate romantic relationships, but also to all kinds of relationships. The relationships we have with children, with parents, with friends, across the board, these pieces really apply, because in the end, relationships are far more similar than different. And there are actually two ways that we can build connectedness. One way is the way that, you might typically think of it, right? So how we behave toward somebody else. But then there's another really fascinating way, and that's actually what we do in what I call in an in-house way. The way that we think about our partner, the way we think about the relationship, the way that we feel about ourselves. It's very tempting, I think, and this is something that many people can overlook, understandably, because it's definitely not an intuitive thing at all, that how we think about the people in our lives actually affects how we behave toward them. It leaks out in these really subtle ways. So I'll talk about a few ways that we can change how we think about our romantic partner, and then also address a few ways that we can behave differently toward a partner to turn the tide. One way in terms of how we think about a partner, the first would actually be being mindful of goals and having approach goals rather than avoidance goals. So approach goals are the way that we think about opportunity in a relationship. It's when we think about how we can be a better partner, ways that we can love our partner better, make our partner laugh, surprise our partner, show our partner how much he or she is loved. It's really the equivalent of what I think of as the carrot hanging out on the stick. It's what you're chasing in the relationship. That's different than avoidance goals, which are really more like potholes in a relationship that you're trying to avoid, right? So it's more, what if I say this thing and this person gets upset? Or what if I do this and the person rejects me? What if I take this chance with my partner and there's a problem? So approach goals are really about making the relationship better. Avoidance goals are about just preventing it from getting worse. And sadly, when we think from a more negatively based avoidance goal place, our relationships are actually more likely to decrease. So the more that we can think in really positive ways about what we're aiming for rather than what we're trying to avoid, that's a really important start.
And that makes perfect sense, mm-hmm. you know, in regards to coming from a positive place or coming from a negative place. Mm-hmm. And how much of this do you think is the fact that we seem to be getting so much more negativity dumped on us, be it the media, be it social media? There's so much more negativity. Do you think that's seeping into the point that it's causing people to work more from that negative position in their own intimate relationships?
You know, I think that in terms of, definitely if we're taking on negativity ourselves, and if we extend that to our relationships and we think about our partner in, you know, more skeptical ways, you know, we don't give our partner the benefit of the doubt, certainly that can erode relationships. And I think it really depends on whether we transfer the negativity that we're encountering in the media into our own relationships. For some people, that may be the case. For others, maybe not. I think that one area in particular where relationships are more vulnerable is in the messages that people encounter about, and this is actually a really big one, is the messages people encounter about how relationships are likely to go. So, you know, I think of cultural messages that we get, particularly in the United States, around relationships as almost like having a long-standing romantic, passionate relationship really tends to get equated with the lottery, in a sense, where, you know, it's this thing that we really want, right? This wonderful thing that would be fabulous to happen, but a lot of people, you know, most people that I talk to, and a lot of what we encounter in the media, to your point, really conveys a much more pessimistic view of relationships. And so people go into their relationships with this idea of, well, you know what, it's great now. We even have language for it. It's called the honeymoon phase, right?
Okay.
Everything's great now, but eventually it's going to decline. And although some relationships can decline, the problem is that the science actually doesn't support that view, that it's the natural state of relationships to decline. Newer research has actually found that relationships follow different trajectories, and that there are a number of couples who remain romantically, passionately in love with their partner 3 decades down the line. So, you know, it's something that is eminently achievable. But the problem is, if people buy into that idea, and they think that, well, you know, my relationship's going to go downhill, or it's going to be so-so, then what people wind up doing is justifying difficulties in that way, right? Or they may not really understand the actual power that they have to elevate their relationship in these really beautiful ways. So people wind up saying things like, and I've actually heard people make comments like this of, well, okay, so, you know, just wait. You know, just wait till someone's been married for so many years, and then see how happy they are. And that kind of idea really reflects this myth that as people are together longer, they're just not going to be as happy, and that's just the way it goes. And that's actually not true. And I think that can really poison relationships.
Yeah, and I think that information coming from other people who may think that they mean well. I was thinking about a woman that I knew who talked about the fact that she went to a class to be able to talk to people in regards to improving her relationship, you know, but it was a class of women. And she was telling me about this class, and I was very, very positive in regards to it. In other words, my feedback was, well, that's great. That shows that you really care, and it shows, and I'm talking about all of these things. And this other woman that's part of the conversation says, so in other words, it was a class for how to be a doormat and like it.
Mm.
And I thought, wow. But it was telling her things that she can do that makes her husband happy. I mean, so, but, you know, but for somebody else, so I think somebody who maybe had their own negative issues or whatever, it interpreted something that on the one hand I thought was great, and somebody else would plant an incredibly negative view of it. So yes, that's why I said I love the fact that you're talking about the avoidance goals. It's coming from a negative place, and there are unfortunately people that are going to try and keep pushing things into that category.
Yes, definitely. In fact, as you were talking about that example, what it made me think about is another message that people can get socially is this idea of romantic relationships. And we see this actually in movies, you know, in popular culture, this idea of romantic relationships as being adversarial. And that there's kind of one side that you have two people on, you know, each side of the fence, or that's this idea of a power struggle. And the idea of really, striving to make a partner happy. How do I make this person's life, who I love so dearly, how do I make their life better? You know, we strip away, these ideas, which really aren't true, about relationships being adversarial, about the idea that they're going to decline. Also, if I could put this out there, the idea that there's a Mars and a Venus. Actually, the science shows that men and women are far more similar than different. And that they want connection, and that they want the same things in a partner. When we really strip that away, we just think about two people who love each other. And that's really what this is about. This isn't about one person one-upping the other, or that if someone tries to make their partner happy, that they're being a doormat. In fact, this is about really showing someone love and building trust. And I think that it kind of reflects another idea, which is another aspect of building connection, is just as we think about approach goals and trying to elevate the positivity in a relationship, another important dynamic is reducing negativity. And I thought about this when you mentioned the idea of being a doormat. I think one idea that people have, that many people can have, is that if they try to continue to be polite and courteous and loving, even when their partner isn't being his or her best self, that makes them a doormat. Or that somehow by coming back and showing just as much anger, really getting into the dirt with someone, that somehow that's leveling the playing field. And actually it's not. The good news is that it takes two people to fight. If one person refuses to do it and one person continues to remain kind and loving, a fight cannot get off the ground. And even though, people can be angry, they can be hurt, they can be upset, and they can still talk to their partner in a kind way. They can still honor, and it's not about, kind of putting negative emotions under the rug and pretending they're not there. I mean, partners can say, I'm feeling really upset with you right now. I'm really angry right now, and I'm really struggling with this. There are ways for people to do that without calling each other names, without trying to win a battle, because in the end they wind up losing the war in terms of the quality of the relationship. And so for people, to really think about, to be careful if they're going to go negative, to be very careful. John Gottman actually showed in his research with tons of couples, looking at what they say to each other, their nonverbal behavior, that the ratio of positive to negative interactions in order to have a truly thriving relationship is 5-1. That means 5 positive comments, 5 positive moments, 5 positive nonverbal expressions like a smile and a hug, a laugh, 5 of those for every 1 negative comment. And in couples who wind up not doing well or wind up going on to divorce, the ratio is actually 1-to-1. So, you know, kind of having, balancing out a positive for every negative doesn't do it. The negative actually means a lot for people. It affects people. And so to really offset that with a lot of positivity is important. And so if we can find ways to think about the kind of relationship we want, what kind of relationship culture do we want to instill with our partner? Do we want one where, you know, the idea is that if we're kind, that's considered being a doormat? Or do we want one where being kind is a part of showing love and a part of being the partner who we really want to be, tapping back into those approach goals?
Now, how does someone deal with that when it doesn't appear that it's 5-to-1 on both sides? So I think that you have a level where you can have two people that come in and they appear to be secure and they fall in love, and then part of love sort of brings on a vulnerability. Now, once you have that vulnerability, and you start to see things, and then an insecurity starts to creep in. If one person's doing a 5-to-1 and the other's doing a 1-to-1, and then you have that feedback of the people on the outside that are your friends that are looking in and think that they're helping, saying, see, you're now being a doormat, or see, you're now being taken advantage of for whatever reason. How do we fight that and communicate it in such a way that it doesn't get to that point? You're very similar to you know, the name of your book, where you're together, but you're feeling alone.
Yes. I think that one thing is for what can often happen is when there's a 1-to-1, the other partner, you know, where a relationship can really kind of slide down is if the other partner also gives in and starts behaving in a more negative way. And that could be either through being more critical, or that could be another thing that can happen is begging and pleading with the person, right? Like, you know, why aren't you talking to me? You know, why don't we cuddle anymore? Right? What's going on? My please, you know, you've just got to do something differently. I'll leave if you don't stop this. So those kinds of efforts to change, oftentimes what people will do is they won't actually maintain that 5-to-1 ratio. They'll wind up sliding into a more negative direction. Again, from a well-intentioned place, you know, it would seem to make sense that by, you know, telling a partner how upset you are, like begging with them and pleading with them to change and telling them what they're not doing, that would seem to work. And yet it tends to push a partner farther away. That said, if someone can hold on, if someone can kind of turn the tide back and have more of a 5-to-1 ratio and really hold that and get validation from people who support them trying to be the best partner they can. And I think that's a really important piece, is definitely not going it alone, but also seeking out people who support what you're trying to do in the relationship. And if someone can hold on to that 5-to-1 ratio, the odds are that actually the other partner is more likely to come closer. So what happens is people may not hold on to that ratio for long enough, but relationships are ultimately a system. The more that a relationship feels positive and safe, the more apt someone is to move closer. And it doesn't mean that people don't talk about what it is that they want to change, but it's about conveying it in a way that is more productive, right? So for example, someone might say, you know, when we don't talk, you know, I feel hurt. You know, I'm hoping that we can, you know, that we can talk about this more. Would that be okay with you? And really trying to partner with someone, not trying to force them if they're not ready, but being honest about how you feel. And in the end, let's say somebody doesn't change. Let's take it all the way to the, you know, kind of opposite lens of things. If someone doesn't change, then still a person is empowered by thinking about what it is that they want to do with that now. Do they want to stay in the relationship and continue to make things better? Or is there a point where they decide, you know what, I can't do this. And I think that that's something that people also, need to think about is what are they willing to do? How long are they willing to stay in the relationship? What kinds of changes do they want to see in order for them to stay? And I think the most important thing is whether someone stays or leaves, that they always remember that they are empowered to make choices in their relationship. And it's very easy to fall into a place of disempowerment, but to always think, okay, given what's happening now, what do I need and what am I willing to do to move things forward?
Wow. I just looked at the time. I could go on, for another hour easily. We've got some questions that came in. I think I'll put them on the website. Again, for anybody that is out there, if it's something that you're interested in, the name of the book is If We're Together, Why Do I Feel So Alone? If you want to be able to get together or to be able to contact Dr. Parker, you can go to the website. It is drhollyparker.com. If you're driving, don't try to write that down. It'll be on our website. But Dr. Holly, thank you so much for coming on. What is next for you? Is there another book in the works? Are there seminars? What are the things that are going on that people can get more information on this?
Yeah, so thank you very much for asking. So what's coming up next is I'm going to be, right now I'm about to offer another course on close relationships. I'm also going to be writing more about relationships on my blog. So I have I write for Psychology Today, and I also have a blog on my website. So people are welcome to go to my website or to go to Psychology Today. And the title of my blog is called Your Future Self. And so I'm going to be doing more writing there. Definitely, yeah, I've got some other ideas for books in the works. So I'll be sure to keep everyone posted on that as well.
Well, again, thank you so much. And I do take this time to acknowledge you and thank you for putting out information out there that really has an ability to make all of our lives better. And isn't that what our goal is anyway?
Absolutely. Thank you for all that you do. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. And for everybody out there, be sure to put us on your calendar to tune in next Monday and join us in A Leap of Perception, The Transforming Power of Your Attention. And please share our show with your friends by suggesting they visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And if you've already done so and you would like us to read some of your stories or what you wrote in your journal, please email them to westshield@gmail.com and we will put them on the air and talk about them a little bit. So again, for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.